A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We've been doing a series on the major industrial materials, kicked off with plastics. That whole question of what we actually mean when we say something is sustainable or not. And the natural follow-up, the thing Daniel's been prodding us toward is, okay, if not plastic, then what? What do we reach for? And for a lot of people, the answer is wood. It feels obvious. It grows. It's natural. You walk into any store and it's everywhere.
Daniel wrote us a whole prompt on this one. Let me read it out. He says, continuing our episodes talking about the major materials in our world and sustainability, we talked about industrial plastics and how they challenge the idea that all plastics are inherently bad. Or at least they make us think, if plastics are bad, but these things are needed for storage and industrial storage, what would we move over to? That shifts our attention toward all other materials. I tend to think of wood and steel. Within those two worlds, we have lots of divisions, and we'll talk about steel in our next episode. Today, let's talk about wood. Walk into any IKEA, and besides the inferior plastics, you'll see lots and lots of wood. This is another finite resource that we should talk about.
He goes on. Hang on, there's more. He wants to talk about where we're in terms of pressure upon specific types of wood in different places around the world, deforestation, and in 2026, which is a few years away from the 2030 goals, what the current progress looks like. And then he says, if we looked at wood not from an aesthetic standpoint, which he's not suggesting is the right standpoint, types of woods are embedded into the fabric of communities and building styles wherever they are. But if we were to look at them purely from a commodity standpoint and a resource standpoint for a second, what wood species would we point to as the drivers of what wood is actually used in, where it makes sense at the moment, ranging from furniture through to other items that aren't decorative but functional? So, the double state of wood and forestation in 2026, that's the ask.
That's a layered prompt. Commodity species, deforestation trajectory, the 2030 checkpoint, and the substitution question all at once.
So today we're walking into the forest, literally and metaphorically, to ask, what's wood in 2026, and can we keep using it the way we do?
And I think the place to start is the tension that makes this whole conversation uncomfortable. Wood feels renewable in a way plastic never does. A tree grows back. The carbon math seems cleaner. But the scale of global industrial demand turns that simple story into something much messier. We're consuming forests faster than they regenerate in a lot of the places that matter most, and the species we actually build with aren't the ones you picture when someone says, save the trees.
Right. The word wood does a lot of hiding. It lumps together old-growth tropical hardwood that took 2 centuries to grow, and a plantation pine that was harvested in year 12. Same word, completely different ecological story.
So let's structure this. 3 lenses. 1. Wood as a commodity, which species actually move the global economy, stripped of aesthetic framing. 2. The deforestation picture and whether we're on track for 2030. 3. That, if not plastic, then wood. Question. Is the substitution even sustainable if we scale it?
Let's start by getting the lay of the land. Literally. What does the global forest look like in 2026?
The FAO just released their Global Forest Resources Assessment in 2025, and it gives us the clearest picture yet. The headline is, mixed. Global forest area is still declining, but the rate of net loss has slowed compared to previous decades. From 2020 to 2025, net forest loss was approximately 4.7 million hectares per year. That's down from 5.2 million in the 2010 to 2020 period.
So directionally good, but still losing forest.
Still losing, and 4.7 million hectares is, what, about the size of Denmark every year? Something like that. The progress is real, but the absolute number is still enormous. And that net number hides a lot. Some regions are gaining forest. Asia, largely driven by China's afforestation programs, shows net gain. Europe and North America are relatively stable. But South America and Africa account for the vast majority of the net loss.
which means those afforestation gains in China aren't offsetting what's happening in the Amazon or the Congo Basin in ecological terms. A monoculture plantation in China isn't a replacement for primary tropical forest.
No, and that's the crucial distinction. The WRI Forest Pulse data for 2025 hammers this home. Primary tropical forest loss, that's the irreplaceable stuff, the old growth is still alarmingly high. Brazil, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Indonesia remain the top three countries for primary forest loss.
But Brazil's story has shifted, hasn't it?
Dramatically, and it's worth dwelling on because it's one of the few bright spots. Brazilian Amazon deforestation dropped roughly 50% from 2022 to 2024 under new enforcement policies. The Lula administration came in and actually started enforcing existing laws, satellite monitoring, cracking down on illegal clearing. It worked. But 2025 saw a slight uptick.
So, political will is fragile.
That's exactly the lesson. Policy works when it's enforced, but the moment enforcement slackens, the pressure returns. There's too much economic incentive to clear land for cattle and soy. The demand doesn't go away just because the government changes.
And the DRC is a different story entirely.
Completely different. Forest loss in the DRC continues largely unchecked, and it's not driven by industrial logging the way people assume. It's small-scale agriculture and charcoal production. Millions of people relying on wood fuel for cooking, clearing small plots for subsistence farming. That's much harder to regulate than a few big logging concessions. You can't just shut down a company and fix it.
Charcoal is the hidden driver in a lot of these conversations. People picture timber trucks, but it's often someone cutting trees to cook dinner.
And that ties into a number that always surprises people. Globally, about 50% of all wood harvested is still used as fuel, cooking, heating. In industrial economies, that ratio flips. We use most of our wood for lumber and paper and engineered products. But globally, fuel wood is still half the story.
Which means any conversation about deforestation that only talks about furniture and construction is missing half the picture.
Right. Now, the 2030 goals. The Glasgow Leaders' Declaration on Forests and Land Use was signed in 2021. Over 140 countries committed to halting and reversing forest loss by 2030. We're now in mid-2026, roughly the halfway point of that commitment period. And the consensus is, we're not on track.
Not even close?
Not on track doesn't mean no progress. It means the trajectory, if extended, doesn't hit the target. Brazil's improvement shows what's possible, but the DRC and several other countries are moving in the wrong direction. Indonesia has actually made some gains. Their deforestation rate has dropped significantly from the peak in 2016, partly due to palm oil moratoriums. But the aggregate global picture is still net loss, and the rate of improvement isn't steep enough to hit zero by 2030.
So the halfway report card is, we know what works, we're just not doing it everywhere.
And the places where it's not being done are some of the most biodiverse forests on Earth. That's the uncomfortable part. You can plant 1 billion trees in China, and it doesn't replace what's being lost in the Congo Basin.
So that's the forest level picture. But when we walk into IKEA or a construction site, we're not buying forest. We're buying specific species. Let's talk about which ones actually move the global economy.
This is where Daniel's commodity lens really helps. Set aside aesthetics, the walnut veneer, the mahogany trim. There are four species groups that dominate, and they're not the ones that show up in furniture catalogs.
Hit me with the hierarchy.
Number one, far and away, pine, Pinus species. This is the workhorse of the Northern Hemisphere, construction lumber, furniture frames, paper pulp. It grows fast, it's widely distributed, it takes well to plantation forestry. If you buy a 2x4 in North America or Europe, it's almost certainly pine or spruce.
And spruce is number two.
Spruce, Picea species, is the other dominant construction softwood, especially in Europe. Stronger weight-to-strength ratio than pine, widely used in structural timber. Between pine and spruce, you've covered the vast majority of dimensional lumber in the developed world.
Then we shift to the global south.
Eucalyptus. This is the fast-growing champion. Originally from Australia, now planted across Brazil, India, South Africa, Southeast Asia. It's used for pulp and paper, but increasingly for engineered wood products. Eucalyptus grows absurdly fast. In Brazil, eucalyptus plantations yield 40 to 50 cubic meters per hectare per year.
And what does a natural Amazon forest yield by comparison?
2 to 3 cubic meters per hectare per year. so you're getting 20 times the wood from the same land area. That's why eucalyptus dominates the commodity wood market in the tropics.
And that sounds great until you look at what a eucalyptus plantation actually is.
That's the plantation paradox. Eucalyptus plantations are ecological deserts. Very low biodiversity, high water consumption, eucalyptus is thirsty, and they can degrade soil over multiple rotation cycles. You're solving the deforestation pressure problem on paper by producing more wood on less land, but you're creating a different set of ecological problems in the process.
It's not solving deforestation, it's moving it. You're not cutting old growth, but you're replacing a diverse ecosystem with a monoculture.
And that trade-off is real and worth having honestly. A eucalyptus plantation is probably better than clearing primary forest for the same wood volume, but it's not sustainable forestry in the way the term gets used in marketing.
What's the fourth species group?
Teak and other tropical hardwoods. Tectona grandis is the big one. This is a much smaller volume than pine or eucalyptus, but disproportionately high value and ecological impact. Teak is used for outdoor furniture, bow decking, high-end flooring. It's naturally weather-resistant, which makes it almost irreplaceable for certain applications. But it grows slowly, and the demand has historically driven illegal logging in Southeast Asia.
And plantation teak exists now, right?
It does, and that's changed the market significantly. Plantation teak from Costa Rica, Ecuador, even parts of Africa has taken pressure off natural teak forests. But plantation teak is lower quality. It grows faster, the grain is wider, the oil content is different. Purists will tell you it's not the same wood.
Purists always say that.
They do, but in this case, there's a functional difference. Old growth teak has higher natural oil content, which is why it lasts 50 years outdoors untreated. Plantation teak needs more maintenance. So the commodity story is pine and spruce for construction in the north, eucalyptus for pulp and engineered wood in the south, and teak as the high-value niche player.
Now layer on the engineered wood revolution, because that's changing the demand picture.
Mass timber is the biggest shift in wood construction in a century. Cross-laminated timber, CLT, and other engineered products let you build mid-rise and even high-rise buildings out of softwoods like spruce and fir. You're essentially gluing layers of wood together in alternating directions to create structural panels that rival steel and concrete in strength.
And this is no longer experimental.
Not even close. As of 2026, over 1,800 mass timber buildings are completed or under construction globally. That's up from roughly 500 in 2020, a threefold increase in 6 years. There are mass timber skyscrapers going up. Milwaukee has one. There's one in Brumunddal in Norway. There are projects in Vancouver and Tokyo.
The sustainability pitch is that wood stores carbon rather than emitting it the way concrete production does.
That's the argument, and it's directionally true. Concrete accounts for something like 8% of global CO2 emissions. Wood sequesters carbon for the life of the building. But the math gets complicated when you factor in forestry practices, transportation, and what happens at end of life. If the building gets demolished in 50 years and the wood rots or burns, that carbon goes back into the atmosphere.
It's carbon storage, not carbon removal. A delay, not a solution.
A potentially useful delay, especially if it buys us time to decarbonize other sectors. But yes, it's not a permanent sink.
Now, Daniel's other question. The if not plastic, then wood. Substitution. How far can that go?
It's already happening in packaging, single-use items, pallets. Wood is replacing plastic in a lot of applications where the plastic was chosen for cost, not for some unique material property. But the trade-offs are real. A wooden pallet versus a plastic pallet, wood is renewable and biodegradable, but it's heavier, less durable, and takes up more space. A plastic pallet might last 100 trips. A wooden one might last 10.
The life cycle math isn't obvious.
It depends entirely on the application. For long-lived structural uses, a wooden beam in a building that'll stand for 80 years, wood is hard to beat. For a disposable fork you use for 10 minutes and throw away, the renewability argument gets weaker because you're still consuming material and energy to produce and transport it.
That's where the framing breaks down. People want wood good, plastic bad, or vice versa. And the real answer is, it depends on what you're doing with it.
The three questions I'd want someone to ask when they're choosing between materials. 1. Is this wood from a certified sustainable source? FSC or PEFC? That's not a perfect guarantee, but it's the best proxy we have. 2. Is this application suited to the material's life cycle? Wood for long-lived structures, not disposable items. 3. Could a recycled material serve the same function with lower total impact?
That third one is where it gets interesting. Sometimes recycled plastic is actually the better choice.
Sometimes it is. And that's deeply unsatisfying to the part of our brain that wants a clean moral hierarchy of materials. But if you're making a park bench that'll sit in the rain for 30 years, recycled plastic lumber might outperform wood on every metric. Durability, maintenance, total life cycle impact.
Where does this leave us on the 2030 goals? We said the world isn't on track.
Not on track, but the trajectory matters more than the absolute position. Brazil showed that policy and enforcement can cut deforestation in half in 2 years. That's genuinely impressive. The DRC shows what happens without governance and with deep poverty driving subsistence clearing. The solutions exist, but they're not purely environmental. They're economic and political.
The charcoal problem in Africa isn't going to be solved by a certification label.
It's going to be solved by electrification and clean cooking fuel, which is a development challenge, not a forestry challenge. And that's the thing that gets lost in a lot of deforestation coverage. It's often a symptom of other problems, not the problem itself.
The uncomfortable truth is that wood isn't a simple, good alternative to plastic. It has its own sustainability challenges that depend entirely on where and how it's sourced. A 2x4 from a managed pine plantation in Sweden is a completely different product from a teak deck chair made from illegally logged Myanmar timber, even though both are called wood.
The plantation solution, which seemed like the answer 20 years ago, has revealed its own limits. Fast-growing monocultures reduce pressure on natural forests. That part is true. But they're not forests in any ecological sense. They're wood factories. Calling a eucalyptus plantation a forest is like calling a cornfield a prairie.
The biodiversity difference is orders of magnitude.
Water use. In water-stressed regions, eucalyptus plantations can lower the water table and compete with agriculture. South Africa has had serious debates about this. Eucalyptus is a major industry, but it's also a water hog in a country that doesn't have water to spare.
What's the actionable takeaway for someone who's trying to make better material choices? You mentioned 3 questions. Let's put some flesh on those.
First, certification. FSC and PEFC aren't perfect, but they're the best tools we have for tracing wood back to a managed source. If you're buying wood products and sustainability matters to you, look for those labels. They're not a guarantee of perfection, but wood without any certification is a much bigger gamble.
Second question.
Match the material to the lifespan. Wood makes sense for things that last. Furniture you'll keep for decades. Structural timber in buildings, flooring. It makes less sense for disposable items, even though it's biodegradable. The energy and land that went into growing that tree should be amortized over a long, useful life.
And third?
Don't default to wood just because it feels natural. Ask whether recycled plastic, bamboo, or some other material might actually have a lower total footprint for the specific application. Bamboo, by the way, is its own fascinating story. It's technically a grass, grows absurdly fast, and has structural properties that rival hardwood. It's not a perfect solution either, but it's another tool in the toolkit.
Bamboo is the material that makes you feel like you're cheating. A grass that grows a meter a day, and you can build scaffolding with it.
It's remarkable, and it doesn't have the deforestation baggage because you harvest it annually without killing the plant. But it has its own processing challenges and transportation footprint. Nothing is simple.
Which brings us back to the core insight. The wood versus plastic. Framing is too simple. The real question is about circularity, longevity, and matching material to application, not choosing a single good material.
That's where I think the mass timber boom is interesting. It's using fast-growing softwoods in long-lived structural applications. That's a good match of material to lifespan. The carbon stays locked up for decades. The wood comes from managed forests, and it's displacing concrete. That's the kind of win that's actually a win, not just marketing.
But the scale question looms. If mass timber keeps growing at this rate, and wood-based packaging keeps replacing plastics, and fuel wood demand stays high in the developing world, at what point does demand outstrip sustainable supply?
That's the open question I keep coming back to. We might see a wood peak, a point where the sustainable yield of the world's forests can't keep up with demand, and we start making hard choices about what wood gets used for. Do we prioritize construction over packaging? Fuel over furniture?
Or we start pricing wood differently. If the externalities were actually priced in, biodiversity loss, carbon release from clearing, watershed damage, the cheap pine 2x4 might not be so cheap.
That's the policy lever nobody wants to pull, because wood is embedded in housing costs and everything else. But if we're serious about 2030, that's the kind of conversation we need to be having.
Well, that's where we'll leave the forest today. Next episode, we're picking up the other half of Daniel's framing, steel, which has its own sustainability challenges, its own commodity story, and its own uncomfortable trade-offs.
Steel is a whole different beast, recycling infrastructure that's been in place for decades, but the energy intensity is staggering. I'm already excited.
Of course you are. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
Don't hug a tree until you know where it came from.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.